readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today's matinee takes a slightly different direction than usual. We'll be exploring the world of the theater, previewing audio selections of famous playwrights, touching on novels that retell classic theater, and I had the privilege of attending a recent conference, the City Rights Weekend, a conference for playwrights by playwrights, where I met some fascinating folks intricately involved with playwrights and the future of American theater. So here goes, curtains up.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Lovers of the Great White Way, let's start with a master, the Neil Simon Collection. This audio features 10 essential plays by one of the world's most celebrated, translated, and widely performed playwrights. You'll be treated to performances of Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, The Prisoner of Second Avenue, California Suite, Chapter 2, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, Broadway Bound, and Lost in Yonkers. I know which my favorites are. Some of the actors performing include Laura Linney, Ed Asner, Richard Dreyfuss, Marcia Mason, Sharon Gless, and Nathan Lame, just to name a few. What a treat. Let's listen.
Yes, I'll go over everything tonight. I'll meet you in Schraff's at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll go over the briefs. Hey, what kind of a tie do I wear? I don't know. I thought something maybe flowing like Oliver Wendell Holmes. Right. Did you hear? Did you hear?
What about tonight?
I've got to be in court tomorrow morning. I've got my first case.
What about tonight?
I'll have to go over the briefs. Marshall has to be in Washington tomorrow, and he wants me to take over with Frank. But it's really my case. Oh, Corey, baby, I'm going to be a lawyer.
That's wonderful. I just thought we were going to spend tonight together.
No, we'll spend tomorrow night together. Well, I hope I brought those affidavits.
I brought a black nightgown.
Marshall had everything laid out when I was at the office. It looks simple enough. A furrier is suing a woman for non-payment of bills.
I was going to cook you spaghetti with white clam sauce.
We're representing the furrier.
In a bikini.
He made 4 specially tailored coats for this woman on Park Avenue. Now she doesn't want the coats.
Then I found this great thing on 8th Street. It's a crossword puzzle with dirty words.
But the furrier can't get rid of the coats. She's only 4'8", so he'd have to sell them to a rich little girl.
Then I was going to put on a record and do an authentic Cambodian fertility dance.
The only trouble is he didn't have a signed contract.
I'm trying to get you all hot and bothered, and you're summing up for the jury. The whole marriage is over.
Oh, Corey, honey, I'm sorry. I guess I'm pretty excited. You want me to be rich and famous, don't you?
During the day. At night, I want you to be here and sexy.
I will, just as soon as Birnbaum versus Gump is over. I'll tell you what, tomorrow night is your night. We'll do whatever you want.
Something wild, insane, and crazy?
I promise.
Like what?
Well, I'll come home early and we'll wallpaper each other.
Oh, Paul! How wonderful. Can't we do it tonight?
No, we can't do it tonight because tonight I've got to work. Except, where do I sit?
The furniture will be here by 5. They promised.
5? It's 5:30. What do we do, sleep in Bloomingdale's tonight?
They'll be here, Paul. They're probably stuck in traffic.
Well, and what about tonight? I've got a case in court tomorrow. Maybe we should check into a hotel?
We just checked out of a hotel. I don't care if the furniture doesn't come. I'm sleeping in my apartment tonight.
Where? Where? There's only room for one in the bathtub. Where's the bathtub?
There is no bathtub.
No bathtub?
There's a shower.
How am I going to take a bath?
You won't take a bath. You'll take a shower.
I don't like showers. I like baths. Corey, how am I going to take a bath?
You'll lie down in the shower and hang your feet over the sink. I'm sorry, there's no bathtub, Paul.
Boy, of all the nights. Boy, it's freezing in here. Isn't there any heat?
Of course there's heat. We have a radiator.
Well, feel this radiator. It's the coldest thing in the room.
It's probably the boiler. It's probably off in the whole building.
No, it was warm coming up the stairs. See? It's nice and warm out here.
Maybe it's because the apartment is empty.
Well, the hall is empty too, but it's warm out here.
It'll be all right once I get a fire going.
A fire? You'd have to keep the flame going night and day. I'll call the landlord.
He's not home.
Where is he?
In Florida. There's a handyman that comes Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
You mean we freeze on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays?
He'll be here in the morning.
And what'll we do tonight? I've got a case in court in the morning.
Will you stop saying it like you always have a case in court in the morning? This is your first one.
Well, what'll we do?
The furniture will be here. In the meantime, I can light the stove, and you can sit over the fire with your law books and a shawl like Abraham Lincoln.
Is that supposed to be funny?
No, it was supposed to be nasty. It just came out funny. What are you doing?
I'm checking to see if the windows are closed.
They're closed. I looked.
Then why is it windy in here?
I don't feel a draft.
I didn't say draft. I said wind. There's a brisk northeasterly wind blowing in this room.
You don't have to get sarcastic.
I'm not getting sarcastic. I'm getting chapped lips.
In a closed room.
Well, how's this for an answer? There's a hole in the skylight.
Gee, I didn't see that before, did you?
No, I didn't see the apartment before.
Well, all right, Paul, don't get upset. I'm sure it'll be fixed. We could plug it up with something for tonight.
How? That's 20 feet high. You'd have to fly over in a plane and drop something in.
It's only for one night, and it's not that cold.
In February? Do you know what it's like at 3 o'clock in the morning? In February? Ice cold freezing.
It's not going to be freezing. I called the Weather Bureau. It's going to be cloudy with the lights and...
What? What? A light what?
Snow.
Snow? A light... It's going to snow tonight in here?
They're wrong as often as they're right.
I'm going to be shoveling snow in my own living room.
It's a little hole.
Yeah, with that wind, it could blow 6-foot drifts into the bathroom. Honestly, Corey, I don't see how you can be so calm about all this.
Well, what is it you want me to do?
Well, go to pieces, like me. It's only natural.
I've got a better idea. I'll keep you warm. And there's no charge for electricity.
Susan Westfall is co-founder of City Theater in South Florida and serves as the literary director for the company. She is responsible for establishing relationships with playwrights, publishers, literary agents, and other artists to find the best and most interesting work for her company to produce. Her own plays have been widely produced in South Florida. I spoke with Susan recently at City Writes, a gathering of emerging playwrights from South Florida and across the nation. Composed of master classes, workshops, mentoring, public readings, and forums, City Writes is a collaboration with regional and national playwright organizations, including the Dramatists Guild of America, the Actors Theater of Louisville, the American Voices New Play Institute, and the South Florida Theater League. The conference's goal is the creation of new work through professional education and relationship building with a collective body of writers whose 10-minute plays are performed at the Summer Shorts Festival by City Theater and other stages in South Florida and beyond. Welcome, Susan. As The Book Report is a show on readers, for readers, and on reading, what plays do you recommend? Have you read lately that people might find out in the universe that they could pick up and read? Or classics?
Well, I could mention a bunch of titles of short plays. It's not really going to resonate. What I am going to suggest, and this is what I do when I'm teaching playwriting, when I'm with other playwrights, and happily, I can now say I too will be a published playwright. There are wonderful compilations and anthologies that anyone can find on a bookshelf, or you can order online. But they're collections of 10-minute plays. Some of them are through Actors Theater of Louisville. Smith and Krause does an amazing compilation every year that is the best short plays of 2011. What that's going to mean is there may be 25 plays in that anthology by all kinds of playwrights, well-known playwrights, playwrights you've never heard from, playwrights who are writing about any kind of subject. And in dipping through that book over the course of lunch or at night before you go to sleep, You're going to visit many, many worlds. You're going to discover so many characters, and they're all going to be involved with something. And as a reader, I have to say, it's very hard to put one of these collections down. It really is. It's just compelling stuff. And editors who put things together like this, they have their own plan, I suppose, but it's a remarkable kind of a book to read if you've never done it.
With budgeting and dollars being so short, do you think that aspiring playwrights are kind of not pursuing their love and going into other things, or are you heartened by the crop of writers that you're seeing today?
Oh, I'm definitely heartened. Some of it is a writer is a writer is a writer. A playwright is a very interesting kind of writer in that, yes, we write on our own, like most writers, but we are writing with the idea of collaboration. We give birth to a script with the idea that it will move on, if it's a successful piece of writing, either to a production where now the creative influence of directors and actors and designers takes it out and puts it on a stage for many, many more people to see and enjoy. The times that we live in provide ample material for playwrights to look at and write about. It's remarkable. And the fact of the matter is there's a huge boom and growth in the 10-minute play. There's little theaters, big theaters, festivals like ours, although ours is the largest festival of this kind, but writers are compelled to write their stories. And the good news is, you know, a 10-minute play can be produced on any kind of a budget. It's a shoestring budget, a larger budget. It all depends. But maybe we call it the attention span kind of theater, the short attention span theater. People want to write, they want to sit in a theater and see about that much, and then boom, there's another play that comes up, boom, another one, and you just go on the journey. So I'm totally heartened. Playwrights will write anyway, no matter what the economy. I don't know that a great economy has always worked to our benefit, but we've been managing for 16 years, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for the future.
Okay. What advice do you have for my listeners out there who have a play tucked in their drawer but don't know which way to go to try to make it?
Well, first of all, I do recommend going out and getting one of these anthologies to take the fear factor out of it. If you read these plays in an anthology, I have to tell you, you will find your imagination totally fired up. You'll see what are the things that you know that are infinitely theatrical. The best advice I can give anyone who aspires to be a playwright, or and it comes from being a playwright myself, is that the play cannot exist only on a page. So you need to hear it. You need to, even you gather your friends and family in a living room and you say, please read my play. Just read what is on the page. And you get, that's how you learn what your play is about. And that is the next step to getting it out into the world if you believe in your play.
So as far as the attendees for City Writes, who are they and how did they get here, and what's up for them? What's next in their future?
It's very exciting. When we invented City Writes, it was with several ideas in mind. It's very important for writers to get out of the writing room and to get into rooms together. It's very important for theater companies like City Theater to know who the people are behind the laptops, behind the pages and pens. It's very important. So something like City Writes in South Florida means I may get to know playwrights from Chicago or Colorado or New York or California. I also may find some playwrights from Fort Lauderdale and Miami or the islands or Key West who have come up for this weekend to give themselves this wonderful gift. So that's what I'm finding.
So do attendees actually need to be invited, or can they go on a certain website and kind of pitch themselves to be able to attend?
Nope, the door is open. The door to come to City Rights is open. We charge a nominal fee and to help offset our costs. But no, anybody can come.
Tell us for next year, the website where listeners can go to find out more about how they might be one of the incredibly fortunate people in this room next year.
We have a website. It's www.citytheater.com. And when you go online, just browse that page and find submissions. We have submission guidelines on there just for anyone interested in sending us a play. We have the information on City Rights and the dates for next year and how to register. Or anybody can always get me at susan@citytheater.com.
Okay, this is great information. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, I appreciate it so much.
Bye.
Bye.
In Macbeth, a novel, literature's most infamous married couple receives a vital, edgy retelling. The book is written by A.J. Hartley, a professor of Shakespeare at the University of North Carolina, and David Hewson, a best-selling author of 16 novels. Macbeth, the war hero and patriot, is doing everything in his power to hold together Duncan's crumbling kingdom, beset by sedition from within and threats from beyond Scotland's borders. But when Duncan, contrary to ancient Scottish tradition, turns to building a family dynasty instead of rewarding those who have borne the brunt of the fighting, Macbeth and his wife make plans of their own, plans designed to hold both the nation and their strained relationship together. Sinister figures who claim supernatural knowledge spur them on, but the terrible outcome is as much about accident and failure as it is malevolence. This is Macbeth as you've not heard it before, a story of valor in battle, whispering in shadows, witchcraft in an ancient landscape, and the desperate struggle of flawed people to do what they think is right. Alan Cumming's performance is a spellbinder.
The pair scatter separately through the mist and thickets like malevolent ghosts. The crone low and swift on her black sticks, the other a tall, hunched, muscular figure, that of a sullen thief out for booty. The young one stays there, hidden by the gorse and thistle, smelling the earth and the blood beyond, peering towards the battle and the tall, commanding figure in its midst. That warrior is in heat, she murmurs, as am I. Macbeth. 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 The man didn't turn. He was listening. Some far-off sound caught on the cold, wet air at the very edge of hearing. Macbeth. Speak, he answered, wiping the blood and sweat from his face. Whatever it was, the words were gone, or perhaps nothing more than one more fleeting illusion, a passing ghost in the midst of battle. There's a fleet landed down the loch, said the sergeant, a heavy man who always looked as if he'd spent the night in a ditch. Vikings came under cover of night from the west through the Sound of Mull. A raiding party, an unwelcome though not infrequent visitation upon Scotland, like pestilence or fleas. Where are they now? The first boats are docking at Inverlochy. The men in the castle have fled already. There were scarcely 20 soldiers anyway. The rest are with the king, on the far side, almost at Loch Ness. The absent king. Why had it taken Duncan so long to cross the Highlands from his eastern base in Forres and join the fight against the rebels in the west? Now there were two fronts, two enemies, the Scottish traitors and the Norsemen. He could picture the new battleground, Inverlochy, a handsome village in the foothills of Ben Nevis, 15 miles in a short loch crossing from the insurgent castle at Ballachulish they now besieged. Thanks to that brief stretch of water which Macbeth's boats commanded, they had a little time to spare between the present battle and the next. He nodded and looked back to the hill fort around which his men had hunkered down, their eyes on its smoking battlements, set on an expansive crag of grey slate, trying to picture the forces gathering around him. The great glen ran like a diagonal sword slash across the neck of Scotland. From Inverness in the northeast to Loch Linney in the south. Past purple and dun heather hills beside ribbon splashes of jewelled water. Macbeth and his men had spent the best part of a month chasing and killing MacDonald's treacherous army the length of it. His soldiers were weary to be home, and so was he. This fighting needed to be brought to a close. MacDonald's inside, thought Macbeth, his stomach clenching, jaw tightening. This is his final stand. Inside and peering through a slit window with his dogs at his heels. The Vikings must wait or do their worst. I've no time to deal with bandits. Once the rebellion's over... My lord, said the sergeant. He turned and caught something behind the soldier's eyes, a flicker of apprehension or dread. These are no bandits. Sweno, the king of Norway himself, is with them. They mean to stay. The man's eyes flickered and dropped to the rain-sodden heather, his face reddening. To stay? How do you know? Demanded Macbeth. They sacked a village on Mull, left a single survivor to make sure word got out. They seemed sure they could divide our force, either side of Inverlochy. How... Macbeth knew the beautiful island in the Hebrides, and could imagine the devastation and death the Vikings would bring, as always. The ruined sheepcotes and shattered fishing boats, the smell of smoking thatches and chicken coops, weeping women and spilt blood. He turned into the stiff breeze and blinked before letting his gaze return to the rough stone tower with its crumbling curtain wall set on the grey slate scarp.
Gary Garrison is a playwright and author, as well as the Executive Director for Creative Affairs of the Dramatists Guild of America. The former Artistic Director and Division Head of Playwriting at NYU, he continues working with graduate playwrights. As a guest artist and lecturer, he's traveled the country, speaking to playwrights in universities, small and large theaters, and playwright organizations. In addition to his plays, Gary writes screenplays and is the author of The Loop, a newsletter for playwrights, and he works with the Tony Committee. He's also written several books, including A More Perfect 10, Writing and Producing the 10-Minute Play, and the new Improved Playwright Survival Guide, Keeping the Drama in Your Work and Out of Your Life. Welcome, Gary. Thanks for stopping by today.
My pleasure.
You have written both short plays and full-length plays. When you have an idea germinating, how do you decide its final form?
I think the story decides its final form. You know, I write for myself, and I write to understand an issue or a problem or a thought or a question that I might have. And so when I feel like the question has been answered, then the container has been defined. So if I'm trying to understand why, extraordinary loss or grief or whatever it happens to be has presented itself into my life, then that will tell me whether that's 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever. I just keep writing the story out until I'm satisfied.
You're here and you're teaching, and I know you do quite a bit of teaching. How do you steer a gifted writer into choosing their art form?
Oh gosh, that's a really good question. I'll just have to put it back on me. It chose me. You know, the theater was a place for me to be my most free. And so it allowed me a place to express myself and to imagine other worlds and to be other people and to share stories that I didn't hear anywhere else on the kind of creative artistic landscape. So, you know, oftentimes, I don't know that we choose it. I think it chooses us. Or at least that's my personal philosophy.
In this very challenging economy, with money for arts being so slashed, are you seeing a reduction in the numbers of aspiring playwrights because they just feel, I'll never make it? Or talk about what you see in the next crop.
Right. Well, it's tough being a playwright. There is no question about it. And you know, the opportunities to be produced in this country seemingly feel like they're shrinking, and probably are. So I think what playwrights do is that they figure out how to cobble together lives and careers through teaching, through writing, through being produced, through working in city parks with kids, through... I mean, there are so many ways in this day and age to be the artist that you want to be. I think, you know, the good old days of I'm going to be a playwright and I'm going to make my living as a playwright and I'm going to... I wouldn't say those are over because that's just not true, but I think it has become more difficult. So because of the, because as you said, because of the economics that are involved. You know, I'm a real proponent of if you have a story to tell and you are of the theater, you tell that story and it will find its audience. And maybe that's a table of 12 people or maybe that's a theater of 1,200. It will find its way. And that's probably the most important thing, just to tell the stories that you're meant to tell.
So in your very, very extensive travels, you haven't felt the need for young playwrights to head off to, you know, the Northeast. I mean, tell us about, you know, when you've had your socks knocked off in Omaha or...
I think great theater, you know, in this day and age particularly, I think there was a time where we would have said that maybe the Northeast was a place that focused a lot of great theater. And certainly there's a lot of good theater in New York. There's extraordinary theater in Chicago and Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, Boston, Miami, Houston, New Orleans, because, again, going back to your statement that you made earlier about economics, you know, in this day and age, it's tough for anybody to live, say, in a huge metropolitan city. It's just hard. It's expensive. It wears on the soul. And in the day and age of the internet, of course, we don't have to be in these big metropolitan cities. We can be in Iowa. We can be in, you know, a small remote town in New Mexico, or 'cause those stories can be told and translated out and about without us actually having to be in residence somewhere. So I see great theater all over this country, and thankfully.
Now, I heard you speak about this to your students, but for the listeners who have their play tucked in their drawer and are wishing, hoping, believing, what's your advice to them to get started?
Mm-hmm. Well, there, again, going back to the, it's crazy about the internet, right? But, you know, going back to the internet, one of the things that we probably should spend some time doing, which none of us like to do, by the by, is to research what theaters do the work that we write, because not every theater does our work, right? We all write very unique, very different stories, and theaters across the country tell very unique, very different stories, and some produce historic drama, and some produce stories by and for women, and some produce gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered stories. And, you know, there are theaters that are very specific to what they produce. Then there are theaters that will produce just really good, interesting plays. So the first thing that I would do is that I would get on the internet and say, well, first thing I would do is I would make an assessment of, this is what I write. This is what I write. These are my stories that I tell. And where in this country is doing that? And how can I find that? And that's as simple as sitting down at your keyboard. It's really that simple. Or belonging to an organization like the Dramatists Guild, or belonging to organizations like New Dramatists in New York, or the Minneapolis Playwrights Center. There are these institutions all over this country that are here to support and nurture playwrights that you don't have to be in residence for.
What are your upcoming projects?
I'm writing a play right now about people of age falling in love, because I don't know that we see that very often. I mean, we certainly see 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds, which are all glorious, but these are people that are in their 70s. And I love the idea of that. I love the idea of people finding love in that part of their life, and that there is an extraordinary opportunity, you know, when you're 72 years old, to have more life. It's not over. So that's that part of it. And also, in this particular story, these are two men and two women who find love later in life with each other. So I certainly haven't seen that story very often.
Is there a working title?
Buddy.
Buddy.
Mm-hmm. Huh. It's the name of one of the central characters, but it's also the idea of in life, or maybe at that stage in life, maybe what matters most is to have a buddy, as well as love, as well as, you know, all those lovely things. It is, as I said earlier, it is difficult to be a playwright in this day and age, but it is a noble cause, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. There is so much in this world that we don't understand that comes at us from all directions, whether it's a tsunami in Japan or earthquakes or tornadoes in this country. I mean, it's kind of a weather thing in that description. But it's also a president who is pulling us out of a war earlier than what he had, you know, any of us thought was going to happen, or a president that keeps us in a war longer than what any of us are comfortable with. How are you to make sense of all that? And what are we supposed to do with our feelings about that? Because I certainly have feelings about them. And I think the theater is an extraordinary place to help us understand those things. And there was a time in our history when that's what the theater was for, was to educate and to... And it still is, to some degree, to educate and to inspire, to question, to provoke, to consider, to think, to... And that's the power of the theater. The power of the theater is an immediate medium that that involves and engages an audience in a way that film and television simply don't. They do it in a different way, but they don't do it in the way that the theater does. And when you sit collectively in an audience and you are laughing as one, you are crying as one, you are thinking as one, you are being challenged as one, in with live performance, there is nothing like it. And so to my mind, it doesn't matter if I make a nickel or if I make $5 million. That's not what I'm there for. I'm there to understand stories.
Oh, thank you. That's very thought-provoking stuff. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's been my pleasure.
In Patti LuPone, a memoir, Patti writes, narrates, and brings life to her roller coaster ride of a career. Now, readers, as you are all too aware, autobiographies can sometimes be egocentric. Fortunately for us, Patti's story is punctuated with honesty and self-effacing humor, and peppered with a few well-placed expletives thrown in for good measure. She recounts her early years on Long Island, her time at Juilliard, her first tastes with success and failure, and her landing of the coveted role of Evita on Broadway. You'll hear the thrill of live theater, the backstage battles, the sacrifice of a personal life, the joy of acting, and the love of a live audience. They're all rolled into a thoroughly entertaining book.
From June till September, the festival presents concerts and performances for thousands of people who sit in the Pavilion Theater or in Martin Hall or picnic on the lawn. Whenever I walk the grounds, I think what a great way for a kid to grow up, climbing the kid-friendly sculptures while Beethoven, played by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, is wafting into their tiny subconscious minds. Ravinia has a very large, multi-generational, and loyal audience, plus some of the hippest camping equipment I've ever seen. The people with lawn tickets are serious about their concert-going experience. On any given night, you can see linen, crystal, and crock pots on Eddie Bauer tables inside L.L. Bean tents. A musical theater production presented on the Pavilion stage requires intense preparation and a certain amount of abandonment, because you have at the most 2 weeks to put on a Broadway musical. This Gypsy was highly anticipated because for half of those 44 years, I had been told by fans, friends, and colleagues that I should play Rose Hovick, Gypsy and June's mother. When I read the script, I did not see the monster stage mother that had become the standard description of Rose. I hooked into her love for her children and her desire to do only her best for them, however misguided those intentions were. That's the way I wanted to play her. It was a departure. My director, Lonnie Price, cast a company of extraordinary performers. I was told that some of the farm boys flew in from New York just to audition for it. Lonnie somehow convinced the CEO of the festival, Wells Kaufman, that he needed 3 weeks of rehearsal for this production, which would include our technical week. The technical week is when all of the physical elements of the production come together for the first time on stage. Sets, lights, props, costumes, staging, and choreography. Everybody involved works 10 hours a night trying to coordinate all these elements while also attempting to get the show to under 2 hours of playing time. It's an exhausting week. Then we open. Who came up with that schedule? I'd love to know. The lawn of the Ravinia Festival can accommodate up to 14,000 people. The Pavilion Theater seats 3,200 people. Most Broadway houses seat half as many as the Pavilion. If a production is successful at Ravinia, we play to over 10,000 people a night. As I understand it, the Pavilion and the lawn were heavily sold for the 3 nights we performed Gypsy. I don't remember much about this opening night. I was too nervous. I don't think I gave anybody an opening night card, which is simply a note of good luck and gratitude, one of the theater's sweet traditions. I just buried my head, focused, and went out there. Word of mouth was so good that various producers began vying for the rights to remount this production in London or New York. I waited for the word from Lonnie Price that Arthur Lawrence, who is the show's librettist and controls the rights, would give the consent for the production to proceed. It was a frustrating wait. Finally, I called my longtime friend and press agent, Philip Rinaldi, for his advice. He asked me what my relationship with producer Scott Rudin was. Scott was Arthur's best friend. Philip suggested that I call Scott. I did, but I couldn't get past the receptionist. Philip then called Scott's partner, press agent John Barlow. John paved the way for Scott and me to connect. Scott simply told me to call Arthur myself. Now, there is a long story here concerning Arthur and me and my banishment from Arthur's work, which included Gypsy. It all started when Arthur offered me his play, Jolson Sings Again. I didn't do it, but let's save that story for another chapter. For the moment, let's just say Arthur Lawrence was really mad at me. Really, really mad at me. I now had to call Arthur and plead with him to bring Gypsy back to New York only 5 years after the last revival. I dialed the number. Arthur answered. Hello, Arthur. It's Patty. Yes, I know, he said. I cringed, waiting for the onslaught of 5 years of Arthur's pent-up anger that was sure to follow. Instead, what I got was a compliment on my performance as Nellie Lovett in Sweeney Todd. What? Then he began to talk about Gypsy. He said he wanted to do it, that he would also direct it, and that this production of Gypsy would be different. He wanted less bravura and more acting.
Playwright, actor, singer, songwriter, poet, and scriptwriter, Sir Noel Coward used his talent to amuse to spectacular effect for almost 60 years. In Noel Coward, an audio biography, author, broadcaster, and critic Sheridan Morley writes and narrates an elegant tribute to the star. Sir Laurence Olivier, Lord Mountbatten, and Joyce Carey are just some of the stellar talents who remember the man and the artist. Extracts from interviews with Coward himself, several of his songs and moments from his plays come together to form a fascinating picture of one of the 20th century's greats.
Mr. Noel Coward.
Dance, 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 little lady, youth is fleeting to the rhythm beating in your mind. Dance, 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 little lady, so obsessed with second best, no rest you'll ever find. Time and tide and trouble never, never wait. Let the cauldron bubble, justify your fate. Dance, 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 little lady, dance, 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 little lady, leave tomorrow behind.
That recording was made in Las Vegas in the summer of 1955, and it represents Noel Coward at the height of one of his many careers, that of cabaret entertainer. To see Coward whole, wrote Kenneth Tynan once, you have to see him in cabaret, romping fastidiously through the batwing melodies of his youth and remaining constantly and uniquely in high definition. As Noel once said to me, after playing to pre-war cafe society in London, I played equally happily to post-war Nescafe society in Las Vegas. But even so, the Americans' wealth and glamour were geographically and socially a whole world away from the one from which, half a century earlier, Noel himself had emerged.
I can remember, the months of November and December were filled for me with peculiar joys, so different from those of other boys. For other boys would be counting the days until end of term and holiday times, but I was acting in Christmas plays while they were taken to pantomimes. I didn't envy their Eton suits, their children's dances and Christmas trees. My life had wonderful substitutes for such conventional treats as these. I didn't envy their country larks, their organized games in paneled halls, while they made snowmen in stately parks. I was counting the curtain calls.
Coward's childhood, if one had to sum it up in a single phrase, was suburban, and the surroundings were apt, as he later recalled, to decline into genteel poverty unless carefully watched. Noel Coward was born in Teddington, Middlesex, on December the 16th, 1899.
Traveling Masters is an initiative of the Dramatists Guild Fund designed to bring together the national playwriting community through workshops, masterclasses, and public symposia held at not-for-profit theaters across the U.S. The Dramatists Guild Fund has a 50-year history of helping serve the needs of America's theatrical writers. Historically known for offering emergency grants to struggling playwrights, the Dramatists Guild Fund is looking to its next 50 years by building upon its tradition of service. New initiatives such as the Traveling Masters are raising awareness of the cultural significance of American dramatists. Lisa Krohn came to Miami last month to work with young playwrights and host a Traveling Masters event at the City Theater's Summer Shorts Festival. Lisa has been writing and performing theater since coming to New York from Michigan in 1984. Her play, Well, opened to critical acclaim on Broadway in March of 2006 and received 2 Tony nominations. Her play, 2.5-Minute Ride, premiered in 1996 and later in New York at the Public Theater in 1999. Krohn is also a founding member of the Obie and Bessie Award-winning theater company, The Five Lesbian Brothers, whose plays, Oedipus at Palm Springs, Brave Smiles, Brides of the Moon, and The Secretaries, have all been produced by their theatrical home, New York Theater Workshop. Lisa is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, as well as numerous other awards. Welcome, Lisa. So nice to have you with me today.
Thank you.
Well, for those listeners who aren't familiar, what was your start in this business?
Well, I did Purim plays in my synagogue when I was a child.
So did I.
And ours were called Gunfight at the OK Kibbutz and Broadway Melodies of 400 BCE, and they're still talked about at Congregation Kehillat Israel in Lansing, Michigan. But, I actually had a professional theater job right out of college. I toured as an actor with a national repertory company, and then I went to New York to be... theoretically, to be an actor. I had no thought of being a playwright. I mean, I would have told you there was absolutely no chance that I would ever do that. But I It happened that I came to New York in the mid-80s when there was a very vibrant performance world in the East Village, and I found my way down to the Wow Cafe, which actually still exists, which was a lesbian theater collective, and it was an incredible place. It was, I had never, I saw this play called Split Bridges by a company whose name was Split Bridges. They have done many plays since then, and they've been, the three members of that company still teach and perform. And I had that, Paula Vogel, the playwright, always says every playwright has a God play, and it's the play that they saw that totally changed their lives. And for me, that was the play. It completely changed my life. And it was alive in a way I had never imagined a piece of theater could be alive. So I was from the Midwest. I didn't know anything about anything. I was a little scared of all these, super sort of already avant-garde people, but I just knew I had to be near this thing that I didn't understand, but that was so compelling to me, and be around these people who were doing this kind of work.
Well, as this is the book report, what favorites do you have to recommend to the listeners about reading plays? Where should they begin?
Reading plays. I'm reading a book right now about theater, which is called The Necessity of Theater by Paul Woodruff. And he's a philosopher. And the thing that I teach is, I'm interested in teaching a sort of deeper understanding of dramatic action. And it's exactly what he's writing about, but he's writing about it from a philosopher's point of view. And it was just given to me as a gift, sort of randomly. And I'm really loving this book. I'm finding it quite revelatory. That's not a play, but it's a book about theater that I'm really, really liking. And I teach using a lot of different kinds of forms. I also use a lot the essays of Charles Baxter, particularly his book Burning Down the House, and he writes about fiction writing, but I find a lot of what he has to say about fiction writing applicable to playwriting as well. So, I draw from a lot of different sources to think about playwriting. Really, I remember when I was in college trying to read Sam Shepard's plays and being like, I don't get it, I can't read it. And then you see it and you're like, oh, because it's not meant to be read.
Yes.
It's meant to be seen. And I think plays, particularly the kind of language-based plays or the kind of, hyper-real plays that happened in the past couple decades, are particularly difficult to read sometimes. Anne Washburn is a super interesting playwright, mysterious and surprising. I think she's very underappreciated. Adam Bach is a really interesting playwright. There's a young playwright now, Sam Hunter, who I think is really, really interesting.
So what project are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple of things, but the main thing I'm working on is a musical with Jeanine Tesori, the composer Jeanine Tesori, and we're doing an adaptation of Alison Bechdel's graphic novel Fun Home.
A graphic novel, that sounds very, very new. Are there other people that are working and bringing graphic novels to the stage?
Well, Spider-Man comes to mind.
Okay, there's that, yes.
I think people have done it. There was one a couple years ago called Slug Bearers of Carol Island, and another really wonderful playwright, Dan LeFranc, has done sort of the idea of graphic novel on stage. It was the particularity of this story. I mean, this book Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, it was Time Magazine's Book of the Year in 2005. I'm sure that some of your listeners have read it. Talk about a book to recommend. This is an extraordinary, it's a masterpiece. I have worked with this book now for several years, and the breadth and depth of this accomplishment of this book. And I just have to say, people are slavishly devoted to this book. It is not like anything you've ever read, and it's so human and moving and really extraordinary. So I won't say too much more about it, but it's available, and definitely go out and get Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, and then come see the musical when Jeanine and I finish it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and spending the time with us today. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right.
Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, is performed here by the LA Theater Works with an all-star cast. In 3 short months, Oscar Wilde, the most celebrated playwright and wit of Victorian England, was toppled from the apex of British society into humiliation and ruin. Drawing from trial documents, newspaper accounts, and writings of key players, author Moses Kaufman ignites an incendiary mix of sex and censorship with a cast of characters ranging from George Bernard Shaw to Queen Victoria herself.
By the plea which the defendant has brought before the court, a much graver issue has been raised. In his plea of justification, the defendant has said that the statement is true and that it is for the public benefit that the statement was made. It is for those who have put into the plea these serious allegations to prove to you, gentlemen of the jury, if they can, by credible witnesses, that these allegations are true. Witnesses will be called who will prove the publication of the libel. And my learned friend has the task of satisfying you that there was enough justification for the publishing of that card.
John Sholto, Douglas Marquis of Queensberry, how do you plead?
I plead not guilty, and also that the libel is true, and that it is for the public benefit that it should be published. I wrote that card with the intention of bringing matters to a head, having been unable to meet Mr. Wilde otherwise, and to save my son. And I abide by what I wrote.
From the Star.
This is, without a doubt, the trial of the century.
Mr. Oscar Wilde, examined by Sir Edward Clarke.
I am the prosecutor in this case. I'm 39 years of age. My father was Sir William Wilde, surgeon of Dublin, and chairman of the Census Commission. I was a student at Trinity College, where I took a classical scholarship and a gold medal for Greek. I then went to Magdalen College, Oxford, where I took a classical scholarship, a first in mods and a first in greats. There, I also won the Newdigate Prize for English Verse. I took my degree in 1878 and came down at once. And from that time, I have devoted myself to art and literature. In 1881, I published a volume of poems and afterwards lectured in England and America. In 1884, I married Miss Constance Lloyd, and from that date until now, have lived with her in Tite Street, Chelsea. I have 2 sons. The elder, whom will be 10 in June, and the second 9 in November.
Mr. Wilde, you have published poetry, short stories, fairy tales for children, and the novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes.
You have also toured America and Ireland, lecturing on art, or more specifically, what you call the English Renaissance of Art.
From a lecture to art students given in New York.
I call it the English Renaissance of Art because it is indeed a sort of new birth of the spirit of man. Like the great Italian Renaissance of the 15th century, it possesses a desire for a more comely way of life, a passion for physical beauty, an exclusive attention to form. It seeks new subjects for poetry, new forms of art, new intellectual and imaginative enjoyments. In art, as in politics, there is but one origin to all revolutions, a desire on the part of man for a nobler form of life, for a freer method and opportunity of expression. This Renaissance will create a new brotherhood among men by furnishing a universal language.
Mr. Wilde, you have also written several plays, 2 of which are currently being performed in the West End.
Yes, The Importance of Being Earnest and An Ideal Husband.
When did you make the acquaintance of Lord Alfred Douglas?
In 1891, he was brought to my house by a friend.
My first meeting with Oscar Wilde was an astonishment.
From the autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas, written 30 years later.
I'd never heard a man talking with such perfect sentences before, as if he had written them all overnight with labor, and yet all spontaneous. He did succeed in weaving spells. It all appeared to be wisdom and power and beauty and enchantment. One sat and listened to him, enthralled.
From a letter written in January 1893.
My own dear boy, your sonnet is quite lovely. And it is a marvel that those red rose lips of yours should be no less for music of song than for madness of kisses.
From the moment we met, he made up to me in every possible way. He was continually asking me to dine or lunch with him. He flattered me, gave me presents and made much of me in every way. He gave me copies of all his books with inscriptions in them.
Your slim gilt soul walks between passion and poetry. I know Hyacinthus, whom Apollo loved so madly, was you in Greek days.
I was from the first flattered that a man as distinguished as he was should pay me so much attention and attach so much importance to all my views and preferences and whims.
Winner of this year's Sheridan Morley Prize for Theater Biography, My Life in Pieces, an alternate autobiography, is written and narrated by Simon Callow. Drawing on a lifetime of writing about theater and film, Callow takes us behind the curtain and behind the camera to introduce us to the performances and performers that have helped shape him as an actor and as a public persona, including Orson Welles, Charles Dickens, Charles Lawton, and Laurence Olivier. The book reconstructs the highlights of Callow's career, including his breakthrough roles as the foul-mouthed Mozart in Amadeus. The pieces are interspersed with commentaries on pantomime, nudity, homosexuality, and the many other aspects of a rich and varied life, both on and off the stage.
My background was, I suppose, theatrical, but in the unimaginable past and swathed in myth. My Danish great-grandfather, Jules Guise, had been first a clown, then a ringmaster, then a theatrical agent. His star clients were a 14-strong troupe of midgets called Dr. Zaynard's Lilliputians. His French wife, Thérèse, whom he met when she was riding bareback in the circus of which he was ringmaster, came from a long and distinguished line of circus equestrians. Her grandfather had opened a hippodrome in St. Petersburg, and when he left, the Tsar, who had grown fond of him, gave him, as a farewell present, Napoleon's horse, Splendid, which he then showed off in the capital cities of Europe for the rest of his life. Jules and Thérèse had a son, also Jules, whose wife, my maternal grandmother, was a gifted singer and had briefly been a chorus girl on tour until she ran away, she told me with characteristic candour, after an unwelcome advance of an amorous nature from one of the other girls. I was 7 years old when I received this baffling piece of information. My father's mother, who was French, had memories of the divine Sarah Bernhardt coming to her house in Lyon for tea. Her father was teaching Bernhardt the role of Hamlet. Less sensationally, she'd been friends with Lillian Bayliss's box office manager at the Old Vic, Miss Clark. This ancient history was of purely romantic interest to me. We did about as much theatre-going as any normal middle-class family, no more, no less. In other words, we were not really theatre-goers at all. The annual season of Peter Pan at the now long-demolished Scala Theatre was more or less de rigueur, however. I wrote this piece about my visit to it for Snowden's Christmas edition of Country Life in 1997. I am standing in a queue in a London street on a cold, dark November night in 1953 with my Uncle Morris and my grandmother. I am 4 years old and howling with all the considerable power of my infant lungs. My fingers and toes are frozen, and I don't know why we're here, lined up with all these other people. The bright lights on the front of the building are getting closer as the queue shuffles forward. I howl louder and louder, not in the least mollified by assurances that I'll love it when we get inside. We pass through the front doors and into a sort of hallway, and then on into a vast room with rows and rows of seats covered in red velvet. At the end of the room is a huge curtain, with gold tassels and braid in figures of eight down the sides. I'm more upset than ever, only wanting to be back home in familiar suburban Streatham. Then music starts and the lights go out. Terror.
Readers, I really enjoyed this show. As a frequent theater goer, I love speaking with people who are so devoted to keeping the curtain up, teaching, inspiring, and mentoring tomorrow's playwrights. Hope you've enjoyed our time together, too. Let me know if you have different topics you'd like me to explore on our literary journeys. Drop me a line via the Reader's Corner at bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next week on The Book Report.